Hello and welcome to ICTJ's podcast. In today's episode, we turn to events in South Africa, where victims of apartheid-era crimes are organizing for justice and reparation. To provide an inside look at these developments, we're joined by Howard Varney. He is a senior program advisor for ICTJ and has worked in South Africa since the early 1990s. Howard, thanks so much for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
More than 40 years of apartheid cast a long shadow of human rights violations in South Africa, including massacres, torture, lengthy imprisonment of activists, and crippling racial discrimination. But most efforts to achieve accountability for crimes committed during apartheid have failed, and today victims are still organizing for justice and reparation. Where would you say the state of transitional justice is in South Africa at this moment compared to when so many of the processes of reconciliation started in the 90s?
Notwithstanding the high hopes that we had in the early mid-90s and some groundbreaking work through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that began its work in 1995 and ended in the late 90s, regrettably, progress has been slow, and most distressingly in relation to reparations and justice, most victims are still waiting for adequate reparations to be afforded to them, and the vast majority of victims have not been delivered any particular justice. And here I refer to the cases that ought to have been followed up following the winding up of the Truth Commission, namely cases that were denied amnesty or in which perpetrators chose not to apply for amnesty. There's been little or no follow-up in that regard.
And you mentioned the work of the Truth Commission. This is generally heralded in the field of transitional justice as being a very successful model. But it sounds like some of these issues are far from resolved.
Well, many victims, I think, would take quite a cynical view of the Truth Commission, particularly in the light of the massive, largely positive publicity it received in the media, in books, documentaries, and movies. To be fair, the Truth Commission did do very important work. The commission itself was a product of compromise and negotiation. The amnesty part of it was incorporated in order to buy in the commitment of different parties and individuals. It provided them with something of an insurance policy that they could cash in should they be confronted by potential prosecution. And I think there is consensus that that initiative played some role in advancing South Africa's transition. We always knew that we were in no position to prosecute hundreds, if not thousands, of cases. And so the commission was one avenue in which to seek out the truth and accord a measure of accountability. And where the commission did have quite significant success was in involving the South African public in its proceedings, and illustrating that those who had been kept in the dark now had a good opportunity to see what had happened in South Africa's past. And this they did through a range of initiatives, but particularly in holding public hearings, which was something of an innovation in those days. Prior to the South African Commission, virtually all the other Truth Commissions held closed hearings or private interviews. And the South Africans showed that open hearings played an important role in allowing victims to share their pain and suffering with the nation, but also in ensuring that key issues received a great deal of public attention through the media, through radio broadcasts and TV. And so I often say that it was a journey rather than the end where the South African exercise was quite a successful one. Very few South Africans, particularly white South Africans, can claim that they had absolutely no idea of what happened during apartheid. It's really been in the follow-up that the experience of transitional justice, the commitments, the promises that had been made, by and large, have not been kept. And this has been the most distressing part of the South African experience, which I think very few people outside of victim communities in South Africa are familiar with. So it is seen as a massive success. It's often seen as an example to emulate. In many countries around the world, look immediately to the South African experience in the hope of somehow replicating it. But many are completely unaware and oblivious to the fact that for many, in fact, the majority of South African victims, they are still struggling, particularly in the area of adequate reparations and effective justice.
The promises that you mentioned, was reparations and a reparations program part of one of the promises of the TRC, or was that something that was developed further after the report was issued?
No, in fact, it was part of the promises. Sometimes we refer to it, in fact, as a compact that was made with the nation and in particular victims. When South Africa's transition was negotiated, and in particular it was agreed that there would be a form of amnesty, not a blanket amnesty, but then again there wouldn't be Nuremberg-type trials, there would be a middle-of-the-road-type measure, which we now know as a truth for amnesty, a conditional amnesty. But it was agreed up front that victims, although they would have to make these compromises and accept that in cases where amnesty was afforded, they would lose out on the possibilities of not just criminal justice, but even claiming damages or compensation through the civil courts. That was also taken away from them. But in its place, it was said up front that reparations would be afforded. And that's enshrined in the postscript to South Africa's interim constitution. It's also enshrined in the preamble of the South African Truth Commission Act. And it was said that a particular committee would be established within the South African Truth Commission to focus on the issues of rehabilitation and reparations. And indeed, the South African Truth Commission made quite comprehensive recommendations on rehabilitation and reparations, and they've all been ignored. So you may ask, what in fact has happened? What has been the response of government? The government has so far come back with one particular form of reparations, which has been a once-off pro rata payment to every person who was lucky enough to be interviewed by a TRC statement taker and who was subsequently verified by the commission as being a victim, somebody who suffered harm as in a gross human rights violation. I should add that some 20,000 statements were taken, and of that number, around 18,000 were verified as victims. And of that number, around 16,000 odd have been traced. So those individuals in the year 2000 received a once-off pro rata payment of approximately $5,000 each. And so far, that has by and large been the end-all and be-all of reparations. I should add that there were some interim or urgent reparations that were given during the life of the commission, but those were not too many cases, and the reparations afforded were not substantial. The once-off reparations, unfortunately, have not found favour with most victims, because one hardly needs to say that that doesn't particularly redress particular needs. There's been no attempt to assess needs, no attempt to assess harm suffered by each victim. So if one victim happened to be slightly assaulted by way of punches and slaps during the course of an interrogation, whereas another victim suffered considerably more harm, where you have the head of a family or perhaps many family members being victims of a massacre, a family home being burnt down, where the surviving family members have lost everything, they might have been underage, lost breadwinners, have no ability to pick themselves up and carry on, they got the same payment regardless of the extent of that suffering. So victim groups, in particular, a group that ICDJ works closely with, the Kulamani Victim Support Group, have been campaigning since the winding up of the TRC in the late 1990s, pressing for more adequate and reasonable reparations. And so far that plea has fallen on deaf ears. As a result of this campaigning, and groups who have picked up victim issues, including ICDJ and other organizations in South Africa, we've come together to form an outfit called the South African Coalition for Transitional Justice. We have asked that the Department of Justice, which includes a unit called the TRC Unit, the Truth and Reconciliation Unit, which was set up specifically to deal with the TRC recommendations, and of course to address the needs of victims, we've asked them to engage with us and to sit down with us in coming up with a new plan and a new legal framework for reparations. That engagement has been regrettably limited. In particular, we have sought for the list of victims to be opened up. One of the biggest complaints that many victims have is that they weren't able to make it to the Truth Commission. The Truth Commission had a limited mandate and limited personnel and resources. It couldn't reach out to all victims across the length and breadth of the country. It only operated between 1995 and the end of 1997. Those victims who did not make a statement for various reasons before the 15th of December 1997 are not regarded as victims by the South African government, regardless of what harm they suffered during the apartheid era. Several hundred, indeed thousands, attempted to approach the Truth Commission after that date, and many of them went to Kilimani and these other groups. Kilimani say that they now have a list of more than 100,000 strong, most of whom are not part of the original list. And so we have asked the South African government to abandon what they refer to as the closed list policy. And that closed list policy says that only those on the original list held by the TRC qualify for reparations. So far, we've had no joy. In the middle of 2011, the government published regulations on health and educational benefits. But again, only those on the closed list qualify for those benefits, and they have to jump through so many administrative hoops that we believe very few, even on the closed list, will actually benefit from those particular benefits, which have still not come into action because they haven't been promulgated. So at the end of 2012, we're sitting with a very serious problem. And that is really why the coalition decided to call for a national dialogue on reparations, which was held just a few days ago. And at that national dialogue, another call was made to the government to listen to the plight and the pleas of victims. And we're hoping that government will change course and take meaningful steps to redress the wrongs that so many have suffered, to engage in an open registration process, to properly assess the needs of victims, and to set aside sufficient funds to do it in an adequate manner.
One of the objectives of this conference was to look at lessons learned, and you've mentioned several of them already, but if you were to speak with those in other contexts doing projects of transitional justice that are looking in this kind of rosy way at the experience of South Africa, what lessons can we draw now that maybe we hadn't been able to draw in the past, and what recommendations do you think have come out of this experience of fighting for reparation, for redress for these victims so many years after this process was completed?
Well, a couple of things. In the first place, countries setting out on these important transitional processes really do need to look out at other experiences that have taken place all over the world and to draw inspiration and lessons from those experiences. And in South Africa, although the South African government does send missions out to all corners of the earth on a regular basis, they've yet to internalize those lessons. And although we were inspired by the experiences, particularly of Latin America and Chile in particular, we somehow are refusing to take on other lessons that have emerged from that continent, and in particular countries such as Chile and Argentina, which have taken serious and meaningful steps to redress the wrongs suffered by victims during past conflicts. The most important one that we would like South Africa to learn is that one does require a serious registration program, and that in order to reach out to victims and give them a reasonable opportunity to come forward, it can't be too quick, and it can't be a fly-by-night operation. So, for example, if it needs to take 4 or 5 years or even 10 years, then so be it. I see in Colombia that the victims' law that was recently published there allows for a program that will run for at least 10 years. And I think we need to do something similar in South Africa. Another important lesson is that although the South African Truth Commission Act spoke of the need to provide rehabilitation to victims, it was left rather in an open-ended way. The rights were not defined in any particular detail and not fully protected. Looking back, I would draw an important lesson, and I would advocate that the right to reparations by victims be enshrined in the Constitution as a right within the Bill of Rights. It would be a right to adequate and effective reparations, and that an obligation would be imposed upon the state, and that the state would be obliged to take measures to ensure that those reparations, reasonable reparations, are afforded to victims. And in fact, this very advice we have given to countries in the Middle East and the North Africa, and I'm hoping that in the constitutional building process that it may be picked up, and that they won't make the same mistakes, and that even if they do, victims will be able to invoke the right under the Constitution to force governments to live up to their responsibilities.
Now that we've discussed the state of reparations and the struggle for acknowledgement and reconciliation in the country, what is the state of justice and criminal accountability for some of these crimes?
Again, regrettably, the vast majority of victims have received little or no redress when it comes to justice and accountability. I concede there was a measure of accountability in that the Truth Commission did name names, did identify individuals responsible for gross human rights violations, and did identify those factions and organizations that were responsible for causing a great deal of conflict and pain and suffering. However, as I mentioned previously, there was also an obligation on the state to follow up on cases that emerge from the Truth Commission process. As mentioned, those matters in which the Amnesty Committee denied amnesty on the basis that there was no full disclosure, or on the basis that applicants had simply offered lies and deceit rather than the truth. And also, in the many, many cases in which perpetrators, particularly senior perpetrators in the security forces, spurned the process, they simply turned their backs on the commission and didn't come forward at all. Given our historic Truth for Amnesty process, there was a moral and legal obligation on the state to look at those cases seriously and pursue the ones in which there was evidence and in which victims were wanting justice, and in which it was the public interest to pursue that justice. And on that score, I'm sorry to say, the South African authorities have failed miserably. Instead of picking up these cases, the authorities have come up with policies and protocols in order to avoid their obligations. And in so doing, they have promoted impunity in South Africa, which I think is a dark stain on the track record of South Africa. So, for example, after a few years with families and their lawyers pushing for cases to be taken up, the response of the government was to amend the prosecution policy. You may ask, what is a prosecution policy? in South Africa and in most countries, it's a policy that sets out the typical criteria when a case is to be pursued or not. It essentially deals with available evidence, wishes of the victims and the community, and talks about the greater public interest. But generally speaking, it requires prosecutors to proceed and conduct themselves boldly and fearlessly. That policy, which said those things, was amended to allow prosecutors to now invoke the now lapsed amnesty criteria for purposes of declining to prosecute. This meant that new criteria were now inserted into the prosecution policy, such as apparent full disclosure, such as the measure of brainwashing or indoctrination that a perpetrator might have claimed to have suffered, claims of commitment to national reconciliation, and so forth. Now, normally those criteria would be completely irrelevant for purposes of deciding to prosecute. They may have become relevant for purposes of sentencing, but certainly for purposes of prosecution, they were not relevant. Victims had to approach the courts, and in fact, ICDCA was party to that case. And we had to argue before the High Court that this policy was unconstitutional. It amounted to an impermissible rerun of the amnesty process behind the closed doors of a prosecutor's office. Fortunately, the court agreed and struck it down as invalid and unconstitutional. And in so doing, the judge in that matter said that it was the responsibility of the state to pursue these cases. Families then pressed for further action now that this obstacle had been removed, and families were met with all sorts of excuses, such as the prosecutors have other priorities, they have difficulties in tracing witnesses, and of course they simply don't have resources and investigators. And that's really where we are today. And sadly, some families are even looking at running private prosecutions where they now have to pay for investigators, lawyers and expert witnesses, and bring them together to prosecute privately, which is an enormously expensive and time-consuming undertaking. The South African state has also bent over backwards to accommodate perpetrators through the so-called political pardons process. One of the former presidents set up a special dispensation on political pardons to allow those who happen to be convicted and perhaps serving sentences to come forward and apply for a pardon. And again, this would be on the very same basis as the former and lapsed amnesty criteria to gain their freedom and to have their convictions extinguished. And this process kicked off in 2007. And like the other process that I described, it was behind closed doors. Victims were excluded. Victims, through this coalition, lobbied for involvement, wanted to be able to make representations, and if needs be, argue against the granting of political pardons. That was denied. Again, we had to approach the High Court. Again, the High Court, acting on an urgent basis, issued an order restraining the president from issuing around 150 pardons. The president then took that case on appeal to the Constitutional Court, and there I'm pleased to say that the Constitutional Court upheld the principle of victim participation in this process and instructed the president that he may not issue any pardons until there had been a meaningful consultation process. And that process is currently on the go. Time doesn't permit me to get into the details, but I can tell you that we have objected to the entire process, and we've done so in writing to the authorities, and we're waiting for their response. So that is where South Africa is when it comes to justice for apartheid-era crimes. Very few matters have been taken before the courts, and the majority of victims are still waiting for justice and accountability.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Pleasure.